Hey, glad you can make it. And welcome to the Employee Cycle Podcast, where we talk to HR innovators, thought leaders, and even some disruptors about the latest in HR trends, HR tech, and you guessed it, HR data. Well, you've heard enough of me talking. Now let's start the show. Show. Before we begin, let's hear a quick message from our sponsor.
Hello, HR. It's me, your HR data. And I need to apologize. I'm sorry for being all over the place. I'm sorry for being difficult. I'm sorry for not being there for you. But it's not my fault. You put me in different HR systems and messy spreadsheets. But guess what? I now have a new friend, and their name is Employee Cycle. They can put all of me in one HR dashboard for you and keep me updated and simple so we'll better understand each other. Look, we're smarter when we're working together, so if you want me to show you my full potential, please go to employeecycle.com to get your free demo today. That's employeecycle.com.
What's up, and welcome back to the Employee Cycle Podcast. I'm your host for today, Bruce Marable, CEO of the HR Analytics Dashboard Employee Cycle. And today, I'm excited to talk about building stronger communities within the workforce. We all know that sometimes you might not feel like you have a community or you have other people that you can rally around with and feel included or feel more engaged in the workplace because you have other people that are interested in some of the same things that you're interested in. So today, we're going to talk with the founder and CEO at Invested, Isa Watson, about this huge topic. Let's welcome her to the podcast. Woo! Isa!
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for participating in the podcast. We, as in me and the audience, we really appreciate you.
I appreciate
you. Thank you so much. So, before we jump into the topic, we have to ask you one very important question, and that is, how did you end up in the wonderful world of HR?
Well, completely by accident. Let me just add that. I started my career as a diabetes chemist, where I was an internationally published research chemist. And I went to get my MBA at MIT and then transitioned to the world of Wall Street, where I was, you know, in a lot of product and strategy roles and had a digital product for a division. And one of the things that I noticed, you know, kind of in my time in corporate was really that, you know, the places in the organization that had the strongest workplace engagement. When I say that, I mean, these people were self-organizing to go volunteer together, to go run 2 miles after work together. Those were our strongest performing business units or, you know, parts of business. And so, you know, this whole notion of future of work, right? How do you actually empower employees and give them the tools to succeed in what's, you know, the 2018 workforce onward versus what was, you know, the most empowering thing in 2000. And I think that, you know, kind of seeing that hands-on really got me excited and, you know, just opened my eyes to the opportunity that there was and, you know, tying employee connectedness in a very large way to help businesses, you know, perform better and do better.
Got it. And you already tapped on this or touched on this a little bit already, but what does a community look like in the workplace?
That's a really great question. I think that traditionally communities have been mostly in the context of ERGs, which are employee resource groups, called something maybe slightly different at, you know, a few places. But employee resource groups are essentially affinity groups. So you have the women's resource group, you have the Black resource group, you have the Latino resource group, etc. And the one thing that we're finding is that if a Black woman and a white man are, you know, both in the same, you know, workplace, they're never going to be in the same affinity group, but they may have something very interesting in common. And so this whole notion of groups of interest, you know, is something that the platform helps people organize around. So, you know, some of the companies that we're deployed to, they have the vegans group and the book clubs group and the young moms group and the runners group. And so when we think about, you know, community in the workforce, it used to really be just around identity, but, you know, organic relationships, identity is one aspect of who we are, right? And it's an aspect of who we are that we can't necessarily control, but the interests, you know, and being able to find common interests with people in the workplace, which is exactly how we make friends, you know, which is exactly how we build relationships, you know, in our personal lives. So, you know, being able to bring that capability to the workplace, I think that that's a much larger part of what community is than what it once was.
So it would be awesome if we could learn more about what Invested does and how your company is either helping employees create or support the existing community groups within an organization.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll give you two descriptions. When I describe Invested to my grandmother, who's pretty tech savvy, I might add. Yes, I have to break it down. Pretty tech savvy. I say, you know, Grandma, listen, Invested is something like an Eventbrite meetup and LinkedIn for companies. What I mean when I say that, from a workplace engagement perspective, Invested does have a strong group component where, you know, companies create groups and they have their company verified groups, but employees are creating a lot of groups on their own. Like we've seen, you know, like I said, groups of like wine connoisseurs groups. We've seen, you know, the Downtown Brooklyn Residents Group or the, you know, the South Bay, you know, over in the San Francisco Bay Area residence group. And in that group structure, there are events that you can host specifically for that group, and that you can actually see what's trending. You know, people in that group, what are they kind of doing most, you know, in the workforce? What are they engaged in from an activity perspective? Which leads me to my next point. The platform actually serves as a central repository for all workplace events, leisure activities, and also volunteer opportunities locally. Again, you still have that group structure. So I can actually, as an individual and employee, I can sign up for an event. I can create an event. These are events like, you know, all the way from a really cool React.js or Angular, you know, speaker is coming, and I want to make sure that people know this is going on, all the way to, you know, we're having a potluck on the fourth floor on May 5th. And so this also, again, gives the companies a platform to actually share out their events. So we find a lot of companies sharing a lot of their L&D programming on the platform as well. And the reason that they like to do it on the platform, and one of the value adds that Invested has, is this administrative enabling of connectedness and discovery. And so there's one central place where all of this happens, where you can access things, like I said, as an individual or in a group context. You're able to, the platform handles the logistics. So it integrates with Calendar, it integrates with Slack. You are able to pull things directly into like Slack or HipChat, / events, you know, get some options in Slack, sign up directly in Slack. So that's kind of one component of the group, that administrative events and volunteering and, you know, activities feature. But, you know, another pain point that we're seeing a lot of companies having is around silos. You know, whether an organization is growing fast or whether an organization has been established for a while and is a little older, you know, being siloed by department is a big struggle that they have. And so one of the things that Invested does, in addition to being just a central repository, is it's a smart platform in that it learns about what an employee likes, what they're interested in. And we have a network development algorithm that sits on the back of the platform that actually recommends events and activities to employees on the basis of getting them to broaden their networks at the company and, you know, tap into even more communities. And so I would say that's kind of like the second, you know, pillar of what the platform does. And a third, you know, and you know this pretty well also, you know, there's this emerging need and attention to HR analytics. You know, I spoke with the chief people officer yesterday of a 5,000 person company, and, you know, she actually has hired like a whole entire HR analytics team. And so, and if you look at the HR tech space, you have a lot of data on, you know, ATS systems, applicant tracking, and what the candidate experience is. You have a lot of data on in HRIS, right? So that's, you know, who an employee is, where they live, things like that. And then you have a lot of data on employee engagement survey space. And so what employees are saying, you know, about their experience in the workforce, what you're missing is data about what employees are actually doing and how that maps to an employee's journey, career mobility, and things of that nature. So there's a huge HR analytics component that actually feeds into the admin portion of the platform that gives HR leaders a great sense of that data that they don't have. And so, you know, holistically, again, next generation workplace engagement, but really focused on, you know, being able to discover what's going on in your workplace and engage and sign up seamlessly, being able to build communities outside of your, you know, team or outside of your identity groups, and then, you know, having a great deal of analytics that can help drive, you know, senior leadership and company strategy.
Wow, that was awesome. I just have to go back to something that you said earlier about explaining what you do. You said to your grandmother?
Yes.
Kudos to you for even using something like Meetup as an example to explain that, because my mom would not get that. And at this point, she has no idea what I do. When I tell her, you know, we have a tech company and we're doing analytics and we have a startup, for all she knows and her friends know, I'm at Best Buy working at Geek Squad. So something with computers, right? So that's great. As you were talking, I don't know if you saw the movie The Circle.
I haven't.
About a year or two ago. It was one of those dystopian future books similar to The Hunger Games and a lot of other movies that came out in the last year or two. But the interesting thing, and no spoiler alert for anyone who didn't see it, but the interesting thing about the movie, or at least one of the interesting things, is that she's in this small town. She goes and works at this huge company, which I guess is supposed to resemble Google. And she goes there and everybody is looking at how many groups they're a part of. And who's a part of the rowing club? Who's a part of the hunting club? Who's a part of the gossip club? And basically she's getting a lot of slack for not being a part of all of these groups. Mm-hmm. And people are coming up to her and say, hey, you know, this person has 5,000 points and this person has, because everybody got a point for how many groups they were a part of. So they kind of gamified it to trick people into being a part of as many groups as possible. And she basically got shamed for not being a part of these groups. So I'm curious, not to say that it would go that far, but when all of these different groups are being created, as much as it's creating communities, is it also putting people in silos so that people don't interact with other people because now they become in their different vacuums? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but we really have not found that to be the case. And our customers range, we really focus strongly on mid-market. So on the lower end, our customers are 250 to 300 employees.
Yep.
And on the higher end, our biggest customer is 5,000 employees.
Okay.
And so what we have found is that, you know, there's this, it actually opens up communication in very interesting ways. And even if you aren't part of a group, you can actually explore what that group is doing. And so it kind of breaks down that communication barrier. There's no kind of exclusive club, you know, that these groups are. It's really meant for people to corral based on interests. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, we've seen this. We're not a diversity and inclusion platform. You know, we're really around engagement and, you know, creating strong product experiences there. But, you know, as a result of you know, our strategies in the platform, we've seen and we've heard a lot of employees and the companies talk about how this has driven, you know, inclusion.
Nice.
In very strong ways, you know, even at the from the onboarding stage of an employee life cycle all the way through. And so, yeah, I will say that, you know, the platform definitely has like a nice light, you know, lighthearted look and feel, very familiar to social media that people engage with every day. But we have not, you know, seen that trend, nor have we heard that. We've heard quite the opposite, actually.
Great. And you just touched on it a little bit about how people are seeing D&I impact on this, which is awesome. But I just wanted to go into a little bit about the ROI that you believe companies will receive, and then the ROI that your customers are getting from doing this. Are they looking mostly at retention? Is it engagement? Are people now starting to say, oh, wow, this is an interesting way to impact D&I issues? Because, oh, wow, guess what? Who would have thought that different people from different backgrounds might actually be into the same thing? You know, such a novel idea.
Right, exactly.
So from a ROI standpoint, where our company saying, oh, you know what, we want you to help us with this, or have already helped the, or for your existing customers, you've already helped them. And is that mostly in retention, engagement? What area are people looking for this to help them the most?
Well, the one thing I'll point out is that turnover is at an all-time high, and companies are spending $550 billion a year on turnover. And that includes direct costs, like, you know, training and recruiting, but it also includes indirect costs, like, you know, lost productivity. And another really interesting stat, and the Gallup report shows this, is that only 3/10 of the workforce is engaged. So that means 7 out of 10 of your employees are not engaged, and you're not really getting the maximum value from them. So I would say that's really what started this conversation, kind of the turnover and the engagement, and how engagement actually drives and influences productivity. But, you know, in HR tech, we've evolved over the course of years, and we're growing in this aspect of how do we actually talk about ROI? How do we make the business case for activities and initiatives and technology like this? And I just really want to refer to a study that was led by Greenhouse Software, who we're actually very close to. This study was led by Maya Hosa-Bacchivelli, and it talks about, you know, at a very high level, understanding the ROI of investing in people. And, you know, a little deeper than that, it talks about the methodology behind what they call ELTV, the Employee Lifetime Value. And so, you know, they break down an employee journey into really four categories, all the way from start to fully contributing to decision to leave to last day. But within that, if you look at that, there are four key areas that they have found really impact engagement. And the first is onboarding. Second is hiring. The third is development. And the fourth is culture. And what they did is they aggregated a lot of data from studies over the last 10 years, and also data that they've used from their own company and their customers. And in scenario one, they had two scenarios. In scenario one, they said, okay, this company, company A, has average people practices. And scenario two was that, you know, the company has slightly above average people practices. And this is really, really getting at kind of the engagement aspect of things. But what they found was that for companies that had slightly above average people practices, over the course of 3 years, a salesperson would generate 2.5x more revenue for the firm. So I'll repeat that again. So the employee lifetime value study, which is really ROI on investing in this type of technology, that was led by Greenhouse Software, they found that with companies that had slightly above average people practices, a salesperson in that company would generate 2.5x revenue to the firm over the course of 3 years. And so, and the other thing I want to mention is on that culture piece. I mentioned there were four kind of strategies that they were looking at, you know, four aspects, you know, onboarding, hiring, development, and culture. And they said, the study concluded that companies with slightly above average culture, these aren't like super optimal. This isn't like really exceptional. This is just slightly above average. An employee was likely to stay conservatively for at least a year longer. So think about how much we invest in training new employees, all the knowledge that we lose when employees go. And so when we talk about ROI, to your question, we really think about it in the context of engagement and maximizing productivity for our company, which, you know, they really need. Another thing I'll mention is that we have a customer that is going through laying off employees. And it was really important in that period for them to have invested in place, just to kind of still kind of maintain that community aspect of things. And so we find that both in constricting and growing environments, there's a lot of value in making sure employees are engaged. And in constricting environments, when employee morale is, you know, more at risk, it's very strong. And so that is how I would, you know, kind of address the ROI, but in kind of primary metrics, what we do is we look at, you know, changes in employee NPS scores with our customers. We look at answers to things on the employee engagement surveys, mostly around trust, connectedness, relationships, and community. And, you know, we found very strong indicators in those measurements. But, you know, holistically, that's how we look at it from an engagement perspective and what, you know, lost productivity is. And over time, well, we are pretty confident we'll be able to show, you know, retention measures as well.
Nice. So one of the reasons why a lot of people in the HR space appreciate the podcast is because we actually try to get tangible and actionable steps out of the guest so that they could walk out of, you know, the podcast and say, oh, wow, I can do this. And here are my next steps. Here are my marching orders. So let's start from the top. Is this something that I identify as an issue, or is this something that, regardless of how great I think my culture is, something I need to do to better engage my employees and also make the culture better?
I think that not a lot of people, not a lot of senior people leaders will identify it as a quote unquote issue. But what I will say, with the exceptions of, you know, some of the obvious companies that we've heard in the news a lot over the last few years. But what I will say is that there's a significant return on investment that we've seen in companies. And so what's happening, I'll tell you, what's happening generally is that the solution to this currently is just a really fragmented one. You know, there's some people in the workforce using different tools to create events and logistics and host those, but they're different. They're like three different solutions in the workforce. And these are free solutions that they can use on the internet. You know, from a volunteering perspective, it's just really high touch to really like engage with nonprofits in a effective way. And then on the collaboration perspective, there are a lot of communication tools, but there's no tool that actually captures and empowers, you know, full employee engagement with the workforce. And so that's where something like Invest.it comes in. And so people, what they're doing now is that they're seeing a hodgepodge of things happen in the workforce that are very, that are just, like I said, very fragmented and very inconsistent. And when you have that, you can't actually get any measurements on that. But you're like, oh, it's kind of working. But what they don't realize is that they're missing out on a ton of information. They're missing out on a ton of information by not, you know, having this in one central place with a strategy in one central place. The other thing that I'll mention is that they are really impeding inclusion. So what I mean when I say that is that there are all sorts of personalities that come into the workforce and into the workplace. And there are all sorts of different types of people. So if I, like, say, I play in a softball league in New York City. But in order to know that I play in the softball league, you really need to know someone who knows me to know that this is a thing. Whereas you can have it all in one place, right? And so inclusion ends up being a huge issue. And I think chief people officers and chief HR officers really don't recognize that as strongly. They say, oh, well, you know, I haven't heard it's an issue, but the people that aren't feeling included, that aren't feeling like there are things in the workplace for them, they're not going to the chief people officer or even their HR business partners and saying, hey, I don't feel like I know, because they don't know what they don't know. What you end up seeing over time is that they're less engaged, less comfortable, probably less productive.
So once I understand that this is an issue, should my next step be identifying groups that already exist and then letting other people know who aren't currently aware of them that these are groups, circles, communities that exist? Or should I be focusing on starting something from scratch and saying, hey, we want to make sure that everyone feels included in the different sub-communities and cultures of the business. So we're going to create this group for this and this group for this and this group for this based off of a survey of what people like, and then you can join these groups. How does that work? Work with what's already existing, create new groups, or maybe a hybrid of both?
I think it's a hybrid of both. So on one side, you really don't want to reinvent the wheel, and you shouldn't have to. There's a lot of great stuff that's going on at the grassroots level and people that have stepped up to be leaders. And this is not even their job, but it's something that they're passionate about. And so you do want to find out and survey, like, what are the groups that are in the workplace right now? What are the active ones? And then the second thing you want to survey is, what are they doing? So I would start there. And then the second thing is, if they're serious about this strategy, I would put in place a framework. How do they work together? Or what is it that they have the ability to do on behalf of the company? And quite frankly, we're seeing a lot of companies actually have a budget approval process for these groups, where the group wants to do like a dinner and the company will say, all right, here's $1,500 to go do that, right? And so, you know, being able to, you know, allow them to be organized and figuring out what the landscape is there, putting in place a framework, that's really helpful. And then measuring going forward. So maybe you don't want to put too much, pressure and work onto the people that are leading these kind of voluntarily, but, you know, every quarter or so, maybe like have a quick survey to see what they've been up to. Which is, again, something that we really automate through the platform. And we actually, you know, take it a step further to help people kind of grow in that regard. But in the absence of technology, these are like the three things that they can do to really kind of cultivate community.
In the same vein, how does a company keep toxic groups from being created? When you're dealing with, you said you're dealing with companies from a couple hundred employees all the way up to 5,000, mm-hmm. 5,000s, right? And I'm sure you could work with 10, 20, yep. 50,000 employees as well. So if you have thousands or tens of thousands of employees, let's take the Google example where you have somebody that's alt-right, or I think that's how they were describing him, and how he basically was saying a lot of crazy things about women and not wanting them to work at Google and all this other stuff that was in the news and everybody already knows about. There's no way of knowing whether or not he was the only person that thought like that, or if he was a part of this subgroup and culture that really supported him, which it seemed like to a certain degree there was a couple other people that agree with him, mm-hmm. not the majority, obviously. So how do you try to identify and remove the toxic groups that may be using this type of platform to also spread their message within the community? And have you seen that happen at all?
We haven't seen toxic groups form, but I think, just given my experience in two highly regulated industries, pharma and Wall Street, anything we've built, we have, you know, we think about the controls framework needed to make that solution successful. And so what our response to that is that when we deploy into a company, we give them one of two options. We say, okay, you can deploy in a way that an employee uploads an event, they click submit, it goes live. An employee wants to create a group, they click create, it goes live. Or the other option is for the company to require that those events and groups be approved. And so that ends up being more characteristic of some of our larger customers, even companies that we are going to be working with that are like 10 and 12,000 employees. They want more control over groups that are created just to make sure that it's above board, et cetera. On the former, though, you know, people just go live and things like that. We do have internal conditions that things should not be offensive and, you know, X, Y, Z. And so, you know, we do reserve the right to take something down if it's like a group that has like a racial slur in it, right? And so that's one control mechanism on the more the freer side of things. And on the other side, you know, companies have elected to put in place control mechanisms by way of employees that are approving these events and these groups.
Got it. And what size companies should be thinking about this? I mean, clearly, if you have 10 employees, I think everyone's talking. And everyone may, and you would hope that everyone knows what's going on with each other. But where do you think is the breaking point for the HR leaders that are listening to the podcast now that are thinking, Isa, I hear what you're saying, but I don't think this relates to me. We really have a good handle on what's going on with everyone, maybe up to 20, 30, 50 employees. So what do you think that breaking point is for just to really start thinking about this and saying, no, you actually probably don't know what everybody is into, and you really need to start thinking about how do you better engage all the employees with, you know, with building these strong communities?
I would say the signs start to appear strongly around 200 to 250 employees, and it just kind of magnifies from there. So at 50 employees, you still kind of know everybody. You know everyone's name. People aren't really dispersed generally across multiple locations. You know, 100 is kind of bigger, but I still feel like I know. But around 200 is when two things happen. One, you don't know everyone. Two, the other thing that happens is that there's the people team is very slim, right? At 200 employees, 250, et cetera. And so what's happening is that there's someone on the people team who's responsible for something else, like recruiting, like, you know, just general HR operations. And they're employees that are consistently going to HR and saying, hey, you know, Bob, we want to do this. Or Bob, how do we do this? Hey, how do we do this? And the more and more the company grows, the more those requests become. But already at like 250 employees, those requests are a little overwhelming. And so there's one person that you hire to focus on recruiting or, you know, operations and implementing your new payroll system and all these other things. They're fielding all these requests from people. And so the one thing that we will say is that this whole kind of program manager or people experience manager at companies is actually a real person that companies tend to hire around, let's call it 500 employees. And we've had companies that have said to us, very well-known brands, household brands, that have said to us, hey, because of Invested, we did not have to hire this person. Or like we could actually just leverage it in the platform, and it allowed us to grow more seamlessly and allowed us to kind of contain, you know, community and make sure it was super additive to our bottom line. And so that's what I would say. I would say around 200 to 250 is when it really, really starts to make sense. But the pain points just get, you know, more painful from there.
Got it. Okay. And now let's talk about the learnings that our listeners can get from this conversation. So what have you seen companies, or how have you seen companies doing this poorly, where you clearly identify, oh, you need Invested today because what you're doing sucks and you're going to waste a lot of time, money, and energy?
Yeah, where I've seen companies do it poorly is where they're really focused on controlling programming. So they may take ideas from employees, but essentially they're running the show. They're running the show with what employees are doing, what their interests, I mean, what employees are doing, what opportunities they have. And I think that's not the best and most effective approach. What we're finding, Bruce, just if we look at just how we engage just day to day in our social lives, the whole peer-to-peer component is super powerful. And it's way more powerful than a company to employee component will ever be. The one thing that, you know, where we see companies making mistakes is, you know, taking too much control over programming and not really giving employees freedom to self-organize and kind of take a grassroots approach to engaging. The one thing that we've seen is that, you know, in our platform, there's a really natural peer-to-peer component embedded in the way that the platform's organized. So you can follow coworkers can follow you. You know, you guys, you're in groups with people. We integrate with SSO and Active Directory, so we know what functional group you're in, if you're in marketing or tech or something else. But the one thing I'll say is that we have achieved an incredibly high adoption rate relative to our industry category by really empowering peer-to-peer, but also balancing that with, you know, company needs, et cetera. So what I mean when I say that is that we have seen on our platform an average of at least 52% of employees using the platform monthly within just 2 to 3 months of adoption. Within 2 to 3 months of deploying into a customer. In our industry category, in HR specifically, especially tech that's used by employees, that average adoption rate is more like 10%. And so we've seen on average a 5x higher, and it keeps going up and to the right. And I'll tell you, we actually deployed to another very household name last week, and the announcement hadn't even gone out yet. The announcement didn't go out for a week after we actually granted user access on Okta. It was just part of our timing just to make sure user access was, you know, tested, all that jazz. It was just available on the Okta SSO, and 20% of the whole company had adopted the platform within 4 days of it just being available on Okta. And then the other thing is that people had already created events. They had attended events and created events with their coworkers over the weekend. There was a beach cleanup and all these different things going on. And, you know, the Portland office and LA and all these other places a week before the platform was formally announced. And so I say all that to say that this whole peer-to-peer engagement and driver of activity is actually one that's very strong. When you marry that, especially with what the company is interested in, people want choices and they don't want to feel like they don't have any, or that they're limited to, you know, a company whose management team probably is not diverse. It does not reflect a diverse set of interests, or not as diverse of a set of interests as employees. And so that's one thing where I've seen companies not do as well, by not empowering grassroots organization more.
We always need to learn from other people's failures. So I'm glad that you share that. So now we're going to go into my rapid fire version of questions, which I like to call the real, the random, and the ridiculous, where I ask you a real question, a random question, and a ridiculous question. Are you ready?
I don't know. Okay.
All right. Well, let's go. So the real question, if you've ever listened to this podcast, you know what it is. For those of you who have not, the question is, Aissa, do you like bread pudding? And if so, how do you like it made?
I do not like bread pudding. I think the texture is weird.
I think
the texture is weird.
I should have known this before I interviewed you, because maybe I would have either had you change your answer, or maybe we wouldn't have had this interview. Oh, man, you're breaking my heart. All right, fine. We're just going to skip over that.
Sorry.
No need. Yeah, it's my favorite. I'm a bread pudding connoisseur.
Really?
So I need to know. Yeah, I need people to let me know where I can get the best, the hottest, the greatest bread pudding, wherever they are. So next time I'm in New York.
My grandmother makes a mean bread pudding, so I can put you on.
Done. I will be at grandmom's house next week.
All right. Cool.
All right. The random question. So it's funny, when we first started this, before we started recording, I pronounced your name as Aissa, and you quickly said, no, Aissa. So how many people think that your name is Aissa, and how has that been affected since Insecure came out?
That is so funny. So I get called Aissa probably 98% of the time, someone saying my name for the first time. I try to be so polite about it. I'm like, no, it's Aissa. And I'm named after my grandmother from the Caribbean. And so it's a family name. But since Insecure came out with Issa Rae, so her name is spelled I-S-S-A. Mm-hmm. My name is spelled I-S-A. The way that it's impacted me since Issa Rae has really hit the scene is, when people email me, they'll actually spell my name I-S-S-A. Even if I email them, clearly my name is I-S-A. And so it's like, exactly, it's this like unconscious, subconscious thing. And so, and yeah, people still call me Aissa, and then they spell it like Issa Rae's name, but I only have one S in my name.
Nice. And then the ridiculous question, what are some of the most ridiculous reasons that you've heard companies don't want to create these communities within their workplace? Or have you heard any ridiculous reasons at all?
Yeah, no, I have. I was just actually talking to the vice chairman of a large financial institution a few weeks ago about this. And he was like, why don't we have this, you know, in our org? And I was like, you know, let's call him Bob. I'm like, Bob, glad you said that. Funny thing is, I talked to your org about it, and they told me that they didn't want your employees communicating with each other. And he has to be like 75 easily. And he just looked at me like, he knocked his head to the side. And he was like, really? They said that? He was like, nah, we need to talk. We need to get you in. It's a New York based company. And I was like, well, I'm happy to chat. But that was literally the reason. The company said, well, why do you want our employees to engage with one another? We want our employees to do their jobs.
And wow.
I was like, okay, I hear you. And so, there was another company, that I know where we do have a volunteering component to the platform. So you can discover your workplace events and activities, but you can also discover local volunteer opportunities. And the company was like, this is more of a startup, like 500 employees, between New York and Tel Aviv. But they were like, why do we want our employees volunteering? If they're spending any other time outside of work, it needs to be for work. Why would they want to like spend time doing other things for the community? They need to be working. Wow, okay. I was like, mm-hmm, yeah, great. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I understand, you know, where you're coming from. I would say those are the two most ridiculous things I've heard. Like, one, we don't want our employees engaging or communicating with one another. And the second one was, you know, employees shouldn't be spending time volunteering outside of work. And if they're spending any additional time, it should be like doing more work.
Those are both very ridiculous. Extremely ridiculous. So thank you for that. You answered that question well. And last question of the podcast. What are your final words of wisdom for anyone who's thinking about trying to create stronger communities within the workforce, people who are thinking about it, people who are doing it now but are struggling with it, people who haven't even heard about this concept and are like, oh, this is interesting, and they're thinking about it because you're talking about it now. What are your final words?
My final words would, you know, I just really encourage people to think about how to optimize the performance of your employees, which in turn optimizes the performance of the business. And the one thing I'll just mention to people is that I've heard people sometimes say, you know what, you know, Sarah does a really good job managing this. The interesting thing that we found is that companies go through kind of unexpected turnover from time to time. Sarah could have a situation where she needs to move abroad with her family, or she gets recruited by another company for a big job and she leaves. So I encourage people to put technology in place to sustain that, because right now we find that these initiatives are really attached to people, right? But people come and go. And then what happens is that the strength of that initiative comes and goes. I was at a company a few weeks ago where they said, let's call her Molly, used to run this, but she went to business school. And then it hasn't been picked up in a year. And so my final words of wisdom would really be to encourage people to, like I said, think about and focus on, optimizing employee productivity to in turn optimize, you know, business performance, and think about the measuring around that. And the second thing is really to think about, seriously consider putting a tech system, a technology solution in place to help drive this, so that it is sustained over the course, you know, of time, and that it doesn't fluctuate with people coming in and out of the organization.
Nice. I hope you all were taking notes, because Issa just dropped a lot of gems. So thank you so much, Issa. No, just joking. Thank you so much, Issa, for coming to the podcast. This was awesome.
Woo!
Thank you. This was great. You know how busy founders are. So, you know, I am one myself. So thank you so much for spending time on this. So where can people find you and Invested Online?
So we're definitely on Twitter and Instagram at Always Invested. So Always, ENVESTED. And they can also shoot us an email. Our email address is pretty simple. They could probably guess it. It's info@invested.com.
Perfect. And we will put all of this in the show notes. So, all the listeners out there, if you enjoyed this super awesome episode with Issa Watson, then now I can't even get it right. Then please leave us 5 stars on iTunes. We really appreciate it. And if you have any comments, constructive criticism, feedback, or you just want to say hello, leave us a note. We read them all. It's great. Also, if this is the first time you're listening and you want to subscribe because you don't want to miss any more awesome episodes, please subscribe and download the Employee Cycle Podcast on your favorite podcast player. And for you HR leaders out there, remember to continue to hire, train, and retain the best workforce possible. Thanks. Later, kids.